Good evening. Thank you very much to the Porters for arranging this. It's so nice there's Partners in Torah. I actually started out my professional Kiruv career with Partners in Torah after a long lay sojourn. So I started out as the telephone mentor's mentor when they started out the telephone mentor's program a million years ago, back in the 90s. I hardly remember it. But now I live in Denver, and I do what you heard I already do. So let's jump right in. You're able to prepare a lot. You didn't have to prepare all. I wanted really there to be a system of parentheses for optional parts, but whatever you got to, great. But let's just start with thinking about our topic. We want to take a big leap forward, get some spiritual connections, preparing for Pesach. So let's just start with the name of the holiday. First of all, what does the actual word Pesach mean? So anybody, jump right in. That's so the Paschal sacrifice is a lamb, but the actual word Pesach, to pass over, right? It does mean to pass over. Why is this holiday called Passover?
Because the angel of death was. I'm sorry, the angel of death. This is one thing I remember. The angel of death was going to the Egyptian houses, and the Jewish people put. I don't remember what type of blood. On their door,
That's why the angel of death would Pesach. Right. Yes, excellent. So, does it make any sense that this holiday, the most important event in Jewish history, should be named after the end of one of 10 plagues that preceded the Exodus? Right? Why is it called Passover? It's so strange. Right? Maybe it should be called Exodus Day, Freedom Day, Birthday of the Nation Day. Like, there's a lot of names it could be called. What's up with Passover? Right? Any thoughts on that? Right? It's kind of strange. Why should we? We had 10 plagues. It could have been called Plague Day if you want to call it after the plagues, right? But it's not. It's not even called Plague Day. It's just called a part of one plague. So we really have to look at, there must be something more to the name Passover than the fact that the angel of death passed over the Jewish houses because there was blood on the doorposts, right? So it has to be something deeper. Okay, so then we would have had a Passover if there wasn't a Passover, you're saying?
Right.
Uh-huh, okay. Okay, good.
But why did they even have to do that? They lived in a Jewish neighborhood, uh-huh. Right from the Egyptian.
You're right.
So it's sort of, to me, it never made sense why they had to do that. They didn't live in the same neighborhood.
Excellent question. We know that the other plagues actually delineated the boundaries of the Jewish areas. The frogs only hopped up to the non-Jewish edge, and you knew where the Jews were. The water only turned to blood in the Jewish areas. The Jews were drinking water. Even actually the Jews inside the blood zone were still, their drinks would come into water. And there's a picture, I don't know, my kids colored so many years, with a Jew and an Egyptian drinking with straws out of the same cup, right? But one's drinking water and one's drinking blood, right? And it was that separate. So, but for sure we understand, like the locusts, they only went to the edge of the non-Jewish area. So we know, you're right, the Jews lived in a separate place. So what do you need that? It's actually a great question. It's not one that we're going to look at right now. Okay, so we want to see that there's something deeper in what was passed over. So we were taken out. So you guys looked at, however many of you were able to look at, we have a covenant, right, that happened in the book of Genesis in Bereishit, right, that says, basically, I'm going to paraphrase. You don't even have to necessarily look at the sources here. I want to paraphrase, right? So God says to Abraham, I have been waiting for somebody like you for so long. Finally, somebody who gets it and wants to be in relationship with me. Through you, I'm going to change the entire world. And your descendants are going to inherit the land and become the people who are going to lead the entire humanity to its destiny. And Abraham looks at him and says, how do I know? Right? That's what he says. And so God's answer is not, I'm God, that's how you know. But his answer is, he puts him to sleep and he says, I'm going to take your children. They're going to be strangers in a strange land. And they're going to be oppressed. And then there's going to be an exodus, and they're going to come out with a lot of stuff. What kind of question is that? And what kind of answer is that? And how is that a covenant, right? It's a strange thing. So let's translate basically what he's saying. What Abraham is saying is, okay, God, I get that I have stepped apart from the rest of humanity. That's why I'm called Abraham HaIvri, right? Here's an idea of where we have to see a different name. He's called Abraham HaIvri, Abraham the Hebrew. Why? Because he comes from the other side of the Jordan River. Right, so we're all called Hebrews because, what, we all come from the other side of the Jordan River? No, right? Because we all come from the other side of world opinion. Right, so we're going to look for something deeper in the word Passover like that. It can't just be a geographic thing. It's got to be more. So Abraham stands on the other side of all world opinion, and God says, finally, somebody who gets it, who's apart from everybody, through you, I'm going to change everything. So Abraham's question, how will I know, really could be retranslated as, okay, God, I understand why you choose me, and I understand why I earned this special relationship with you, how I entered it. But how are my kids going to earn it? How are they going to enter this relationship? How are they going to develop into the kind of people that can lead the whole world to their destiny? I don't get it. And God says, don't worry. I have a workshop designed just for them. They're going to go into Egypt. They're going to be oppressed. Regular humanity is going to be squeezed out of them really tight. I'm then going to bring them in that squeezed and oppressed state to Har Sinai and give them the Torah. Well, they'll absorb it beautifully. So the negativity will be removed and the positivity will be added in. They'll be completely transformed and they'll become the Jewish people. That's basically the subtext of what's going on. So that's the promise, right? So now we go into Egypt and we get taken out. Why were we taken out of Egypt? Did we deserve it? Right, to become the Jewish nation. Exactly, we did. That's what we saw in, I don't know if it was the second text, but we saw that God said, I heard their groaning, right? And I took them out. I heard their groaning, saw their oppression, I took them out. It's really fascinating to see. We're gonna look in just a minute when we see 2 years. We're gonna look in a minute and see there's two different nonverbal prayers that the Jewish people utter. And they're at opposite times of the year. So I'll leave that as a question if you can think of the other one. But the groaning is one of them. Okay, so we want to see why the Jewish people were taken out. Right? Was it because they earned it? Right? We know they sank to the 49th level of Tumah. They didn't earn it. They did retain their names. They did retain their language. They did retain their mode of dress. But they didn't earn it. Right? They were taken out because Hashem promised. And that's why. What was passed over was the prerequisite. Right? The need to earn something. Hashem said, you know what? I made a promise and I'm keeping a promise. I'm going to whisk you out. And not just whisk you out. Whisk you out up to a very high level. Up to a level that you completely didn't earn and don't deserve. But because I'm taking you out to fulfill the promise of taking you to my people, you need to be here. Because it's your job to transform the entire world, and you can't do it down here. You have to do it up here. So I'm going to pass over all the work that you didn't do and bring you to this place so that you can accomplish what you need to do. That's what was passed over. Pasach. On everything, right? So we really sank down to this level. We needed to be on this level with this being the middle. And Hashem scooped us right out and put us here. Parenthetically, so that's what we're doing during the 49 days of the Omer, is we're fixing these 49 levels of Tumah down here at the same time that we're building 49 levels of Kedusha up here so that we can then go and receive the Torah on level 50. Right? Level 50 is a special supernatural realm. All right, what day do we have a bris on? The eighth day. What does eight represent? How do you know?
Seven days is ordinary. Mm-hmm. Natural.
Mm-hmm.
So an eighth day is
above nature, right? 7 days of the week, right? So that's the cycle of nature, right? And eight is above. How do you say eight in Hebrew? Shmona, right? So spell it out. Sh-mo-n-a, right? Rearrange those letters and you get nish-m-a, nishama, right? Eight is the realm of the soul. 50 is the number right on top of seven sevens. So it's a super eight. Right? And that's the day we got the Torah, was in the super eight zone of 50. Completely above and beyond. All realms of nature. That's what the Torah is. It's eternity. And it's completely above and beyond seven sevens. That's what Shavuos is. Okay, so now let's look at, so we discussed, we just got to the first word. We're going to go faster to the rest, okay? Passover. Now we know it was passed over, the prerequisites, right? But what is the energy of Pesach? If we want to tap into the energy, so we discussed one energy. There's really two principal energies happening in this holiday that we want to be able to access. Who here has been to Yellowstone National Park? Just one? Oh, wow. Two people. Okay. So let me just give you a quick orientation to Yellowstone, because you need that for this, okay? So it's a chunk of park in Wyoming. There's a figure eight drive, and on that figure eight drive, which probably takes about 3 hours or 4 hours to do the whole figure eight drive, it's a pretty big park, there's many different geologic stations where you can see all kinds of different geologic phenomena. There's geysers, and there's special kinds of waterfalls with all kinds of like white deposits and stuff, and there's jewel-toned hot pools, and there's all kinds of interesting things. It's all powered underneath by one thermodynamic system, right? So there's one system underneath that powers the whole thing, but it manifests in different ways as it comes up from the bottom, depending on the aperture that's there for that energy to express itself through the earth, right? Does that make sense so far? So that's coming up from below. We have spiritual energy that's coming down from above that is powered by Hashem. But it manifests in different ways depending on where we are in the year. Each one of the months has its own aperture, and the energy flows through that month into us, there onto us, and we can tap into the energy of that time. Each yantif is also its own energy aperture, fine-tuned to those days in the month. So we want to understand, what is the energy of Nisan? What is the energy of Pesach? So the energy of Nisan, Rav Hirsch discusses, he has a whole system of letters that you can switch around. So letters that are pronounced in the same part of the mouth can be interchanged. So Nisan, the samech could be changed for a tzadi, because you pronounce it in the same place. So Nitzan is a bud or a blossom. The energy of Nisan is the energy of blossoming. It is spring. It's the month of spring. So it's the month of the beginning of everything. So the essence, the principal quality of the month of Nisan is the month of beginnings. So we saw that the first mitzvah, whoever looked up Shemot 12:2, the first mitzvah that the Jewish people got when they came out of Mitzrayim was Rosh Chodesh, the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. I don't know if you're able to follow the Rav Hirsch. His language is a little bit intricate, but it really pays to read it. And many people need to read it with help because he has Hebrew in there that's not translated, unfortunately. This is actually just an excerpt from his whole essay. It's about a 5-page long essay on that one verse. Because there's two mitzvahs in the one verse. The first mitzvah is to make Nisan the first of the months. No, the first mitzvah is to sanctify the months. The second mitzvah is to make Nisan the first of the months. But wait a second. When do we usually celebrate Rosh Hashanah? On the seventh month, right? Right? So we have a Tishrei Rosh Hashanah, and we have a Nisan Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah talks about four Rosh Hashanahs, actually. One in the beginning of Elul, one in the beginning of Tishrei, one Tu B'Shvat, and there's a machloket if it's the beginning of Shvat, or if it's the 15th of Shvat, and one in Nisan. So Nisan is the, let's just look at the Tishrei and the Nisan Rosh Hashanahs. What's going on with those two? So was anybody able to get to the Rav Hirsch on that? It's a fascinating thing, what's happening there. Let's first go back to just the concept of the sign that's in the sky, because that's the first part of the Rav Hirsch, I think, that you looked at, right? So the first thing that happens, the Jews come out of Egypt, they're out, and Hashem takes Moses and Aaron and says, look up at the sky, see that little brand new moon up there? That's going to be a sign for you to not at all be like the Egyptians. The Egyptians count time by the sun. Sun time makes a year. A year in Hebrew is a Shana. Shana, the root of shana, is the same root as repeat. Right? Like say these words to your children, repeat them to your children. Vishinantam levanecha. Right? Repeat these words. Right? So it's do it again and again and again. Shana is repeat and repeat and repeat. But chodesh means, chadash means new. Constantly do something new. Be new. Recreate yourself. So within the time of the year, which constantly is the same, I want you to now constantly look at the moon. It has nothing really to do with the moon, except for the moon is a sign to remind you, turn yourself back to me. Turn yourself back to me. Don't think that you're born the way you're born and you're going to stick the way you're stuck. Right? That's not the Jewish way at all. As a matter of fact, we believe that not just for Jews, but for all people, we can all choose to be in a direct relationship with Hashem. We don't have to be under the energy that's falling down on top of us. We can all take ourselves out of that system. For sure, Jews are out of that system. The more they're connected with the Torah, the more they're out, which is why we have the phrase, Ein Mazal LeYisrael. It's not translated, Jews have no luck, right? Which is what it sounds like, Ein Mazal LeYisrael. It's when we say Mazal Tov to somebody, we translate it as congratulations, but it's not really. Mazal means a flow. So we're saying you should have a good flow. Mazal Tov, flow well. It should flow well upon you. May the flow be upon you is really what we're saying, right? There should be a good flow on you. The flow of energy coming from above should flow well. That's what Mazal Tov means. There should be a good flow of energy. But really, the best thing is that we shouldn't be affected by Mazal at all. We should be in direct connection and not need to be in that system of nature of that flow of Mazal, but directly connected to Hashem, which every one of us can choose on our own. That being said, so we have this concept of newness, and that was the first mitzvah that we got as Jews, was to renew ourselves, constantly reinvent. It's going to look like you're going into darkness. It's going to look like you're about to die, but renew yourself. It's going to look like you're in a depression. It's going to look like you can't get out. Renew yourself. It's going to look like you lost your job and you don't know what you're going to do. Renew yourself. Reinvent yourself. It's going to look like you don't believe anymore. You're not sure where to go with it. Renew yourself. It's the power of the Jew. Constant innovation. And we see that throughout. We have it spiritually, but we have it scientifically too. We have it in medicine. We have it in computers. We have it in nation building. We have it all over. Jews are new makers. Constant innovators all the time. That's who we are. It sounds strange to say that because usually orthodox and new don't go together in a sentence, right? We're all about old. But the fact is that the first mitzvah we got was to be new. And we're reading this parsha this Shabbos, right? So we have, we're going to go back to these 2 days and 2 years in a minute, but we have four parshiot that we read before Pesach to get us ready for Pesach. Right? And they're just different little sections from the Torah that help us get ready. The first one, we're just going to breeze through them quickly and spend more time on HaChodesh this coming up week. Shkalim, the parsha of the Shekel, reminds us two different things. One, it talks about money. Right? So the reason why we read it before Pesach is for two reasons. One, to remind us to give money to those people who don't have enough to make Pesach. It just rings the alarm. Pesach is coming. Expensive holiday ahead. Share your resources. And the reason why we read that instead of something else about money is because the shekel that we give is the half shekel. Rich or poor, everybody gave a half a shekel to remind everybody that we're all only half a person. We're all incomplete. We're only complete when we join together with a group. So really, it's to remind us two things. Expensive holiday coming. Share your resources. Family holiday coming, get together. Wider sense of family, get together. We're all part of one group. Let's just jump down to the word chabura underneath that for a second. It's a fascinating concept to think about a chabura. Who of you, in the seders that you had last year and the year before, wherever they were, just think for a moment. After you finished your suda, right, now everybody passes out the matzah to have for the afikoman. But really the afikoman is instead of the Korban Pesach, of that paschal sacrifice. Really, what should happen after you've eaten your share of matzah, and after you've eaten again in your Hillel sandwich, and after you've eaten your meal, right, and after you've had your wine, now that group that's in that room is supposed to polish off an entire lamb. The whole thing. Every last bite. Who in this room was in a big enough seder that the entire lamb could have been finished after the meal? Raise your hand. Right? Pretty much only somebody who's doing college kiruv with like 50 guys, right? They could eat a lamb. Like anybody who's had teenage sons knows that like a lamb, not that hard, even after a whole meal, they could do it, right? But if you don't have teenage sons, it means you have to join together with enough other families. That's the halacha. The whole lamb has to be completely finished that night after the meal. After the meal. It's not part of the meal. It's after the meal. And the whole thing has to be eaten. Now, lambs aren't that big, but they're big enough to make you, you know, even more full after you're full. So it just means you need to have a big enough, we probably would need a group this size, right, to be able to finish a whole lamb when everybody's full. So really, it's talking about creating a chabura. A chabura is the name of the group that comes together. They invest in the paschal offering together. They have a representative that takes it to the Beit HaMikdash for them, shechts it, and brings it back, and then they together have the Seder together and then eat that whole lamb together. Right? So it actually, that first shkalim, when we read shkalim, we're reminded, we're a half a person, we have to be part of a group. In order to fulfill the mitzvahs, we have to belong to a community. So it's just raising our antennas about community. Next comes Zachor, right? So we read about Amalek. Remember, don't forget to absolutely not forget to wipe out the memory of Amalek, and don't forget to do it. That's what it says, right? Does that make any sense? Don't forget that you have to remember to not forget to wipe out the memory. Don't forget. Like, if you want to forget, just stop talking about it already. And yet, every year, we're reminded to forget, to wipe out the memory. We have to remember to make sure we forget. So what is that? But it's not about wiping out the people. It's about wiping out the memory, the zecher of Amalek, right? So what is the zecher of Amalek? Amalek stands on the absolute opposite end of the spectrum of the Jews, represents what we don't. Amalek represents might makes right. Through my sword, through my strength, I will grab, I will conquer, I'll take what I want in this world. Right? It's all for me to grab. That's what Amalek represents. And that's really the way the world still, not all the way, but a lot of parts of the world still work that way. However strong I am, that's how much I get. Right? But the Jews represent the total opposite. It's not by our sword or our strength that we conquer anything, but by our ideas, by our intellect, and by our neshama. That's our gift to the world. So we believe in universal education. We want everybody, all human beings, to be empowered by education so that everyone eventually, by their own free will buy into the picture of Hashem Echad, that there is only one Hashem, and that we all humanity, not everybody has to be Jewish, but everybody should be in relationship with the divine, right? So that, and if everybody's in relationship with the divine, so there's lots of different names, but it's interesting that the name that Hashem reveals himself to Abraham when he comes for the bris, for that first covenant, is Kel Shaddai, right? The word Shaddai, which I'll pronounce just for those who aren't familiar. Shaddai, it means enough. He says, I am the God of enough. I want to represent to you through this name that there is enough. There's enough for everybody on this planet. Nobody has to grab. It's not a zero-sum game. I make it all, and I can give it all. There's enough for everybody. All we have to do is buy into the picture of us all working together, creating a synergy, and there's enough for everybody. That's the Jewish message, and that's the opposite of Amalek. That's what we want to wipe out. As Jews, we want to live a life that wipes out the memory of might makes right. And we want to bring ourselves into, there's enough for everybody. We can all work together. And that's part of what's getting us ready for Pesach, our birthday as the Jewish people. Right? Next comes Parah. Para is a fascinating concept. We could go into it for a long time, but we're not going to right now. But that has to do with Tuma and Tahara and Kedusha, right? The opposite of Tuma is actually Kedusha, with Tahara being in the middle as the conduit for Kedusha. The Ramchal defines Kedusha as the integration of physical and spiritual. So Tuma is entering into the decay zone, the unified field theory of Tuma. Every kind of spiritual impurity, ritual impurity, has to do with decay or separation from eternity and potential. That's what Tuma is. And I had to work on that unified field theory for a long time. I got some help from Rabbi Yoel Unger in Denver, with whom I learned. But I was working with a concept that it's connected with death, and it made it difficult to understand why the person who then, why the person who gets leprosy and the person who takes the goat that's tossed off the mountain for Yom Kippur, why do they become tummy? So, because they're not connected with death. But if you understand they're connected with decay or separation from eternity, then it works. So we're not going to discuss exactly why, except for the goat part. The person who takes the goat, the Metzora, also the one with leprosy, separates themselves from the community of Israel. One because of an Avera, one because of a mitzvah. But in either case, they're separated from the community at large. The Jewish people are the eternal people. We're going to live forever. Not each individual component, but as a people, there's eternity in us. So if we separate ourselves from the Jewish people, we enter the zone of Tuma, the zone of decay, right? Because anything that's not connected to eternity starts to dissipate and fall apart. So Parshas Para is, on the surface level, just reminding us, coming up to the Beit HaMikdash, you're about to offer a sacrifice, better start thinking about Tuma and Tahara. You have to make sure you're going to be Tahor so that you can go to the Beit HaMikdash and offer the sacrifice and eat from it. You can only eat from it in that state of Tahara, right, in that state of ritual purity. So that's just to remind us. But really the deeper level is connect to the Jewish people. Connect to the eternity of the plan here. Make sure that you're Tahor so that you can create that unification between physical and spiritual. And finally, this week is the last week that we read the special parashiyot. We read Parshat HaChodesh, where we say, this month shall be to you the first of months. Oh, that doesn't make sense as a translation, though, really. This month shall be to you the first of months. It's a Chodesh Hazeh Yelechem LaRosh Chodeshim. Right? And then it says, this shall be the first month, this shall be the first of the months. If you translate it the way I just said, which is the way it sounds, right? This shall be the first of months. This month shall be the first one. Then you have two verses, two halves of one verse saying the same thing. So Rav Hirsch says, this renewal shall be to you the first of all the renewals. Look at this sign. See this sliver of the moon? It's brand new. Be brand new. This is the first brand newness that you see. You're now the people of brand newness. This month, Nisan, should be the first month within the year. So now we have two clear Rosh Hashanahs, right? We have Nisan as the first one because we call it first. And I heard a shiur many moons ago, and since then I now practice this tip. If Nisan's supposed to be the first month, then it might be a problem to date your check January 10th, 1-10-12, right? Because then you're saying January is the first month.
Well, so, English.
Right, except for. So I'm just saying it's not a halacha, it's a sensitivity. So I personally, whenever I have the opportunity to write the name of the month instead of number the month, I write it. Sometimes there's boxes you have to put in the number. But if you can write it, even if it's just a short little line, instead of putting 01, I'll just write Jan, you know, because Nisan is 01. So I just want to remember that Nisan is 01 when I write my checks. And every time I write Jan or Mar or whatever it is, right, I'm reminding myself Nisan is the first month. I'm not counting their count. I'm counting my count. Nisan comes first. So now we have the birthday of the Jewish people in Nisan and the birthday of the world in Tishrei. Right? Because when on Rosh Hashanah we say, this is the birthday of the world. That's when the end of the whole birth process happened. Adam got a soul. We're 5772 years from Adam getting a soul. Right? We don't really know what happened. I mean, we have little outlines of what happened the first 6 days. But the end of the sixth day was when Adam got a soul, and that's when we count the birthday from. That's Rosh Hashanah. But this is also a Rosh Hashanah. So we as Jews are told to count this as the beginning. So that's the beginning for years. The year count shifts then. But the beginning for festivals, the beginning for all things spiritual, starts now. Pesach is the first of the Shalosh Regalim, not the second. You might think Sukkot is the first, and then comes Pesach. But it's Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot. That's the order that it goes. So this is the first. So let's just review what Rav Hirsch said. It's fascinating. He says there's 2 years and 2 days, two ways to count time. The physical time is counted from darkness, from the fall, the beginning of the fall, where there isn't really anything, right? It's the end of the harvest. So you're really at a stark period when Rosh Hashanah starts. So it starts in darkness. It gets deeper and darker. Goes into the freshness of spring, the brilliance of summer, but ends again in darkness. That's a physical year. And the days, the physical days we see from Genesis, start at night. They start right in the beginning of the evening, right? Move into darker and darker, then to dawn, then to brilliance of midday, but sinks back down into dark. Whereas in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Holy Temple, the days are counted from dawn. They start in the wee hours of the morning. They go into brilliance. And even though they sink into darkness, trial, and trepidation of night, they end back up in the day. And the same thing with the spiritual year. Our spiritual year starts in spring and goes through the brilliance of blossom in the summer, contends with fall and winter, but ends again in the light with potential available. So he says all things physical start in darkness and will blossom, but end in darkness and decay. And all things spiritual start in light, will contend with difficulty, but will end back in the light with potential ahead. So we have those 2 years and 2 days, two different ways of counting time. And that's one of the messages of Pesach also, is we're starting right now, it's fresh. We have the energy of freshness and newness ahead of us. And that's what we can tap. So Pesach, we said Pesach means to leap over, but we can teach the word, we can translate the word slightly differently also. Right? So Pesach could be separated into two separate words. Pesach, the mouth that converses, the mouth that speaks. And if you think about it, the principal way of serving Hashem for Pesach is the Seder, right? Is the Haggadah, telling the story, right? But who's the villain of Pesach?
Pharaoh.
Right. We didn't get it written down in Hebrew here, but let me just tell you that Pharaoh is spelled, if you take the outside letters, you have Pe and He, Pe. And the inside two letters are Ra. Evil mouth. Really goes this way. Evil mouth. Right? Right? So, pe-ra. Right? So we talked about two non-verbal tefillot that the Jews had. They're actually at both of the Rosh Hashanahs. Right? Think about Rosh Hashanah. In Tishrei, we blow the shofar. Right? That is a tefillah that's above words, right? We take the breath from our lungs, put it through the shofar, make a sound that carries our tefillot up, but it's an unarticulated tefillah that's specifically left unarticulated so that it carries the depth of our breath, desires, hopes, and dreams out and up above words. So it doesn't have to be condensed into words and limited by words, right? But what happened in Mitzrayim is that we were so imprisoned that even our mouths were imprisoned by Mr. Pera, right? By the evil mouth guy. He oppressed us so much that we weren't even able to daven. It doesn't say in the verse, Hashem heard our prayer and took us out. He heard our groaning, right? That's a below verbal tefillah. We couldn't even get it up to the level of words. All we could do was groan from the suffering. And the groan was the request to God, but we couldn't even articulate it. We were so enslaved. But at the Seder, our mouths are talking, talking, talking. And the more we talk about it, the better it is. Talk, 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 right? It's the Haggadah, tell the story, ask the questions, right? So we ask questions. We have four questions, and they come with answers. How do you say answer in Hebrew? Tshuva or ana, la'anot, right? La'anot, ana, that's pa'al. And how do you say affliction? Inui, right? It's the same root. That's pl, right? The relationship between pa'al and pl, and I'm just quoting, even though I majored in Hebrew, I really didn't get it. That's the truth. So I'm just admitting to. Pa'al is the soft version, and pl is the intense version. So like shavar is break, shiber, shatter. Ana, answer. Ina, what? Affliction, right? It's an intensive form of answering. Affliction in slavery is your whole being is caused to answer to another. You can't ask a question. You're just in answer mode. Whatever you're told to do, you answer because you're that afflicted. It's a very deep answering. There's no questions in ina mode. There's a question that produces ana, but not a question, only a demand that produces ina, right? So, but at the Seder, we have questions and answers, and we can ask questions and discuss things. It's a sign of freedom that we can discuss things and wonder about things. But here's something that we could wonder about. What's with that cup in the middle of the table? Right? The Kos Eliyahu. Does he really come and take a sip? Right, there's the whole song, don't shake the table, don't shake the table, watch that cup of wine because I want to see the wine go down when it's Eliyahu's time. Right, but in fact, even though our children have been indoctrinated that there is a Jewish Santa Claus, there's not, right? He's not coming to drink from that cup of wine. So what is that cup of wine? Who knows? That's why I had you look at Shmot 6, 1 through 8, particularly in Hebrew. So that's the story of us being taken out, right? But verses, where are they? 6 to 8, if I can find them, right? You have what's referred to as the Arba Lashonot Geula, right? The four words of redemption. Right, so that's why whoever could read that in Hebrew, it says, therefore I say to the Jewish people, v'hotzeti, I will take you out. It's interesting what Hirsch says on that word, not I'll take the burdens off of you and therefore you'll be able to stand up on your own. I'll scoop you out from under your burdens, v'hotzeti. The burdens remain, I'm scooping you out from under them. Right, so v'hotzeti. Then the next, and then half a verse later, v'hitzalti, and I'll save you. V'ga'alti, and I'll redeem you. And v'lakachti, I'll take you to be my people. But if you keep, so that's four cups. Those four words are four cups of wine. But there's really five words, right? The fifth one is v'heveti, I'll bring you into the land. So why do we only drink four cups if there's really five words? Right, so four of those words happened already. And in a way, actually, the fourth word is still happening. Hashem took us to be his people, but we're still becoming, we're still gelling as his people. We're not quite all the way there yet. But for sure the first three and the fourth one happened. But the fifth one, I'll bring you into the land, does not refer to the first bringing into the land when he first brought us into the land. Anybody who has to go, I'm sorry, welcome to leave. Don't feel constrained. It refers to the future, hopefully started already, but the future bringing into the land, the ultimate redemption. So now the question is, what do you do with that fifth word? Do you drink a cup for it or not? We're not quite sure of the halacha. So what do? We pour and drink four cups, and we pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. It's a compromise. We're not really sure what the halacha is. It's a big question. It's actually quite a big question, which we put right in the center of our Seder table. We know there's an answer to that question, but we don't know what the answer is. Eliyahu knows the answer to that question, and when he comes before Mashiach, he's going to answer it. But meanwhile, we put it in the middle of our Seder table. One of the reasons I'd like to suggest that we have it in the middle of our Seder table is to broadcast on this night of receiving the mission and transferring Emunah to generations is there are questions we don't know the answer to. And it's okay. It doesn't mean there's not an answer. We just don't know what it is. But we could still do what we need to do, even in the face of a question that we don't know the answer to. We could live with a question. So we have that question in the center of our Seder table, and we know who's going to answer it someday, but he's not here yet. So we live with the question. Okay, let's go back quickly. Okay. Preparing hearts, kalim, homes, kalim, and hearts for Pesach. Okay, in the light of all this. So homes, I'm going to let the rabbi discuss that. All the stuff you need to do to kosher and prepare, and remember that crumbs are not chametz, except for in the kitchen. You don't have to vacuum every single corner. You have to get it out, but you don't have to like go crazy. Dirt is not chametz either. But that's for the rabbi to actually discuss the halacha of preparing your home. But I would like to discuss preparing kalim for a second and hearts. So kalim, often translated as vessels or sometimes as dishes, but we're supposed to bring our best kalim to the Seder table. I remember many moons ago, one of my teachers, Tehila Yeager, got a gift from her father, Alav HaShalom, Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld. She gave her some money, and she bought china for Pesach. And I thought, wow, that's what you're going to do with your money? Like, you have a special gift, you want china for Pesach. I thought, you know, there's a lot of other ways to spend money. Like, you could have nice dishes, it doesn't have to be china. And so I asked her about it, like, why did you choose china for Pesach? She said, well, it's the night of royalty and majesty. It's our birthday as a Jewish people. So we should have our most beautiful things on the table. I really wanted china for Pesach. I didn't understand it. Now I do. I did happen to find 8 boxes between many amazing savings of Mikasa china. I, too, now have china for Pesach. But it took a while to get that. But the concept is we're supposed to bring our most beautiful vessels. If you have sterling, we kosher it for Pesach. If you have crystal, you kosher it for Pesach. Right? You want to bring your most beautiful things. But one of our kalim, and I just listened to a shiur on tape by Rav Shlomo Freifeld, Alav Shalom, so he said that you're supposed to bring your most beautiful vessels into the sukkah also. Right, one of the vessels that we have is our mouth, right? And that's supposed to be a beautiful vessel that you bring to the Seder table. So I was thinking, how do we prepare that vessel for the Seder table? Right? How do we prepare other vessels for the Seder table? So usually we kosher, and then to make it pretty, we polish it, right? So how will we kosher and polish our mouths? Because especially if our principal avoda, our principal service on that night is done with our mouth, it has to be a beautiful vessel. So the way to kosher a mouth is not boiling water, right? But what does boiling water do? It gets out the negative. So we definitely want to take the negative out. We could start right now by taking negativity out of our speech. And that's, I think, even beyond, of course, the laws of Lashon Hara, we want to make sure that we're keeping. But even beyond that, a harsh word, a sharp word, any negative comment that we might have, we could practice, starting from now, koshering our mouths so that the negative will be gone. But not just that, we want to polish it up so it'll be shiny and pretty. So that means adding in the positive. Extra compliments and extra nice things to say, an extra connection, an extra hello, so that we bring our mouth to the Seder table. It's a beautiful kli. We're bringing our best kalim to the table. And our hearts, right? So we want to tap into this energy of newness, the energy that we have. It's our birthday coming up as a people. And we can take a huge leap right now. That energy is still available to us. It's not that Pesach commemorates a time when there was that energy, when there was that leap. It every year is that energy. It is that leap. If we know, we can jump far. It's totally up to us. We can build the foundation later, but we can take a huge jump. So we want to think about it. How high do we want to go? Where do we want to jump to? What do we want to accomplish? Hashem can totally take us there. So we want to set our sights high and jump. Leap. We can leap over everything to accomplish that for Pesach. So we want to plan for that. So one of the things I want to accomplish, and this is my own personal thing, this is not based on sources, but based on types of thinking in Torah, but it's not. It's my own preparation of heart for Pesach. So I was thinking, how will I get myself ready? We now, Baruch Hashem, have a 4-generation Seder. My in-laws come. A few of my husband's siblings come. Their kids come. All our kids come. We now have 3 who are married, so there's their kids, and we have 4 grandchildren. So that makes 4 generations. It was a long time in coming. A lot, for a long time we made our own Seder. because we were the annoying from ones in the bunch who couldn't be made, you know, Pesach couldn't be made with, you know, those people who insist on a second day of Yontif. So we were on the outs, but now we're on the in because we're the ones who make it, and everybody gathers around us because, yes, it's a lot of work, but we're still doing it. And we have now, it's really a bracha to have all those siblings and all those generations and all of our children and everybody there, but it's also a challenge because all those siblings and all those people and everybody there, families. Rabbi Rieti says that the definition of a dysfunctional family is any family with more than one member. So Baruch Hashem, we have a lovely large family. And there's challenges facing families. That's just the way it is, right? So I want to make sure that I can embrace my whole family, every part of it, every member of it, even the ones who are often difficult for me. So I want to prepare my heart for Pesach. So I was just thinking about my heart. It has four chambers. So I said I have to clean out the chametz, right? Because one of the things we think about with chametz is that it's puffy. It's like the ego. So we want to get our ego out of the way. But so how can we get what's puffy and in the way out of our heart so that there's room for everybody? So I was thinking in the four chambers, just as a breathing exercise, to breathe out the excess lack of humility, the whatever pride or ego that I have that's inappropriate, because a little is appropriate, but whatever's inappropriate should exit. And in the first chamber, I want to invite Hashem to live there, right? I want to create space in me, just like Hashem created space inside Hashem for me to live. I want to create space inside me for Hashem to live. So first, creating space for Hashem. Then, the second one is creating space for family. And you could define on your own how big a family you want to create space for, but I personally have been actually actively practicing in short periods, 30 seconds or 1 minute, of actually visualizing a few of the difficult people that I might be encountering and hearing them say something that is difficult to hear and opening that space up, just softening it, rather than having it seize up, which is the first response, like, ah, right, to open up and to receive that person, not faking it, because I'm good at that. I could fake the smile and feel like it means nothing, but to really receive them for who they are and accept that, so create space for my family. The third chamber is space for community, and again, that could be whatever size you want, whether it's your neighborhood or your shul or your city or Klal Yisrael, however the size of community you want to create space for. And the final one is space for self. Especially because we might have really high goals of where we want to leap to on Pesach. And when we turn around from that space and look at where we actually are, it's easy to sometimes get judgmental about ourselves. I'm not good enough. I'm not working hard enough. I'm not having achieved enough. I'm not where I want to be. My kli is not shiny enough for the Seder table. Like, what am I doing here? But there has to be space inside also to love and embrace oneself, so that one can have the ability to come with a whole heart to the Seder table and make as big a leap as we hope to be able to make. So I want to grant everybody a bracha, bless everybody. They should be able to achieve their desires and jump as high as they can, and Hashem should bolster them up high, achieve the heights, and then they should merit to build the foundation underneath that to sustain it and transform the world thereby.
Thank you.